Matthew chapter 17 is where we pick things up tonight. The end of chapter 16, Jesus has declared what is necessary in order to come after Him. And what is required is to deny myself, take up my cross, and to follow after Him. And Jesus went on from there to describe that it is a life that, you know, it has its sacrifices this side of glory, but it's a life in verse 27 that will be rewarded in this life, which we'll see in a couple of chapters, but also in the life to come. And He declared in chapter 28 that assuredly I say to you, and He's speaking to the disciples at this particular point, and He said to them, assuredly I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. Now, there's a chapter break, and I'm certainly not going to criticize where people put chapter breaks in doing that. But in the original documents, of course, there were no chapters and verses. I'm not complaining that they're there. I mean, how would we begin tonight? Now, turn to that section on the Transfiguration. We'd be 30 minutes getting to it, everybody in the room. So it's nice to have these things the way that they are, but sometimes you have to understand that they didn't stop at the end of the chapter and then pick it up the next day in their daily bread. I mean, they would keep on going in it. And so when Jesus was speaking about those that were going to see Him in His glory and the glory of His kingdom, now He continues, the account does, in chapter 7 to give an explanation of that. And after 6 days, they're in the northern region of Israel, the Galilee region, actually north of the Galilee region there, in the area of Caesarea Philippi. And it says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, His brother, brought them to a high mountain by themselves. The highest mountain in the region in the north is Mount Hermon. And so it's a very tall mountain there in Israel. There's skiing during the winter on it and all, and probably took them about 6 days to walk and make the journey from the area of Caesarea Philippi up onto the uppermost parts of that mountain. Jesus didn't take all of the 12 with Him. He took Peter, James, and John. And a lot of people look at this and they notice that Jesus did certain things with Peter, James, and John that He didn't do with the others. And so they're spoken of as kind of an inner circle among the 12. There are others that think that Jesus took Peter, James, and John with Him continually because He couldn't afford to leave them out of His sight. They might do something. So those of you who are teachers, you understand that the trouble kids, you keep them right there in the front row. The desk is right next to yours because if they had any liberty at all, no telling what they would do. They might cause what Aaron did in the Old Testament with the golden calf to pale in comparison to it. So I am inclined to believe, though, the higher theory concerning them, and that they were being specially prepared for particular places of leadership following the ascension of Jesus. And so He took them, He brought them up on the high mountain by themselves, and He was transfigured. And the word is metamorpho. It is the word that is used for a caterpillar changing into a butterfly. He is transformed into His heavenly glory in front of them. You remember Jesus in John chapter 17 and His prayer that He prayed. He prayed and for the day that would come when His disciples would see Him in His glory and that He would return to the glory that He had left. And so now He's transfigured before them into His heavenly glory. Now, some people look at this and they wonder, why the transfiguration? I mean, why did He do this? And I don't have the slightest idea in terms of being dogmatic related to it. But Jesus is within 6 months now of the cross. So you have 3 years of public ministry kind of behind Him now. And now He's dealing less and less with multitudes dealing almost exclusively with the 12. He's spoken of the fact that the cross is coming, and he knows that the cross is not only going to be a hard thing for him, supremely hard for him, but it's going to be hard for these men. And so he gives them a glimpse of his glory so that when, and you notice how I said glory, and I can do that. I wasn't planning that, but it did sound good, didn't it? The glory. Where's my handkerchief up here? I got to get this thing. But he showed him his glory, and he said, "Brothers, I want you to see my glory." And I don't even watch those guys, and I've fallen into it. But they're going to see it's getting harder and harder. The opposition is getting more and more blatant. And so he's doing things that are greatly to encourage their faith for when the difficult times come. And the Lord is faithful, isn't he, to prepare us for what's coming in our lives. And you get into the middle of it, and then all of a sudden you see the fingerprints that have been in the recent past, you know, to kind of prepare us for the trials that we're going to find ourselves in. So he's transfigured now into his glory before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as the light. And so we're going to, when we see the Lord in his glory, we're going to have new bodies with which to do that. Here they are, and Peter, James, and John, they're going to see it in the tent. But here he is in all of this glory in the transfiguration. And behold, not only was he transfigured, but behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them talking with Jesus. And so Jesus is there in his glory, and now he's having a conversation with Moses and with Elijah. Now, it's nice to see that Moses finally made it into the promised land. Remember, he wasn't able to do that because the law can't take you into the promised land, all of the imagery that's there in the Old Testament. And so, but he does end up in the promised land. But he ends up there with the Lord Jesus, the means by which anyone can enter into the promised land. And so Moses finally makes it, and he has the best Jewish guide you could ever have for seeing the promised land, and that is Jesus himself. Moses here represents the law. I mean, his name for the Jewish people was synonymous with the law. You spoke of Moses, they immediately thought of the law of Moses, the law that God gave to Moses. And that, of course, was the first great division of the Old Testament. We, as Christians, call the Old Testament the Old Testament. But the Jews don't call it the Old Testament. They call it the Law and the Prophets. It has two divisions. The Old Testament does. And the one division is the Law, represented by Moses. And then he is speaking here with Elijah. That's the second great division of the Old Testament. Elijah representing the Prophets. And so here they are. They're talking. And then we know from one of the other Gospels, in Luke's Gospel, that the disciples were asleep. They tended to sleep at times like this, and they were in a heavy sleep. And they wake up from their sleep, and all of a sudden they see Jesus in his glory, and they see Moses and Elijah. And we're told in Mark's Gospel that when Peter saw this, not knowing what to say, he just said something. And so, Peter, isn't it? It's so foreign to you and I. I mean, it's so excellent to learn from Peter. And then Peter answered, and he said to Jesus. Now, you just have to stop. You just love Peter. I do. You have Jesus in all of his glory. You have Moses and you have Elijah talking. What could you possibly hope to add to that conversation? What are you going to say? I mean, what are you going to say that you're going to come off in any way other than, who is this over here? Oh, it's one of the 12 that are going to change the whole world. Really? Really? You know? I mean, here they are with these giants, and Peter is going to to speak up into the situation. Well, you know, the classic lesson as it relates to that is that when we don't know what to say, don't say anything. But that is, you know, easier said than done many times. But he didn't know, and there is, for a certain kind of person, silence in any kind of situation is very difficult for them to endure. They will fill it with some kind of noise, even if it's foolishness, their own. Many of us understand that firsthand. I think that there is an important lesson for being careful about not marring a spiritual situation. Here is Peter. He is in the middle of something that is absolutely awesome in terms of what the Lord is doing. It is a deeply spiritual event that he finds himself in the middle of. And sometimes for a certain kind of person, it is so hard for them to just let it alone. Just enjoy it. If you don't know that you're going to improve it in any way, just let it be. But so often there is that tendency in any kind of work where it's just like, wow, I mean, was the Lord in that tonight or what? That someone feels like they've got to add to it and end up marring it. And so it would have been good for Peter just to have enjoyed it. Easy for us to say, in looking at it, but to learn the lesson that there are times where God just does something, I can't add to it, it's just between him and what he's doing, and for us just to enjoy it. And so Peter speaks, and he said to the Lord, he interrupts the conversation, he said, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Really? Who are you again? You know, I mean, there's Moses and Elijah, and Peter said, yeah, you know, it's good that we're here too. If you wish, I mean, I only want to do it if you're into it. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles or tents. One for you, of course. One for Moses and one for Elijah. And now, he's making a tremendous mistake here, because what he's doing is he's putting Jesus on the same level as Moses and Elijah. He's putting Jesus on the same level as the law and the prophets. And the law of Moses was a revelation from God to man. The prophets and the writings of the prophets were without a doubt a revelation from God to man. But the supreme revelation from God to man came in the incarnation of the Lord Jesus. When he came, and as is spoken in the book of Revelation, the title that he gives to himself as he writes to one of the seven churches, and he declares himself to be the faithful and true witness. Nothing else. No superior witness to the Lord or revelation from the Father than the Son. As Jesus said to Philip, Philip said, just show us the Father and it'll be sufficient for us. And I like what Gail Irwin says. Well, yes, of course it would be. But Jesus said, Philip, if I've been with you so long that you don't know that if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I am the complete and perfect revelation of the Father, of course, because they were one. The writer of the book of Hebrews declared in the first chapter and said, God, who at various times and in different ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son. And so if we want to know what the Father is like, we want to know what God is like, we can't really learn that supremely from the law or from the prophets. We learn it from studying the life of Jesus. And so here he speaks up, puts them all on the same level. And remember earlier in chapter 16, Peter, through some statement of his, forced Jesus to rebuke him and say, get thee behind me, Satan. Now all of a sudden, he forces the Father to rebuke him in verse 5. I mean, all of heaven is silent the majesty of what's happening on this mount. And then while he was still speaking, he's still talking. Isn't that great? Still going on and on about we don't know what. Behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them there on the mountain, and suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And I like it in the old King James, "Hear ye him." Not the law, not the prophets. You listen to him now. And so the Father now corrects Peter, and so Peter has the distinction of being corrected by two-thirds of the Godhead and just slightly over one chapter, you know, and forces, you know. Wouldn't you like to know what that scene was like in heaven? The Father's, I've got to correct this. I can't let this go on, you know. And so he comes in and says, "I love this. This is my beloved Son. My beloved Son." Reminds me of with Abraham and his son Isaac. "Take thy son, thy only son, whom thou lovest." The Father loved his son. That was a loved son on Calvary. That was a loved son who struggled for those every breath. That was a loved son who had pierced hands and feet, covered with the spit of man, covered with his own blood. It was a loved son that went to Calvary to pay a price for you and I to know God tonight. And I like that singularity of in whom, not God isn't, you know, well pleased in the law. He isn't well pleased in the prophets. He is well pleased in his Son. And it is only in Jesus Christ that salvation can be found, because it is only in him that the Father is well pleased. And it is important that all of us have a salvation. That the concern is not supremely with whether the salvation that God has provided us with pleases us. That's not the issue. And the day is coming when it will not be an issue at all. I think that, you know, the absence of brokenness in humility in people taking the Word of God and cutting out this and cutting out that and then deciding what Jesus did or didn't say and then refashioning and reworking the cross and the work of cross and all of these kinds of things. I don't understand it. When I came to know the Lord, I was happy there was a way. There was no complaining. It was awesome that God provided a way for us to be saved. And then to be saved from that and saved into what we were saved in. And so there ought to be just that, you know, awe over the fact that he provided a way at all. And all that matters is that this is the salvation that pleases heaven. This is the salvation that pleases the Father. And only the salvation that is found in him does. And when the disciples heard the Father speaking, they fell on their faces and they were greatly afraid. Do you think they talked with Peter about that later? I don't know. Peter has delivered me from the depths of condemnation many times in my Christian walk. I love that guy. You know. And Jesus came as they're in this terrified condition, and he said, "Listen, this is exactly what I like to see in my disciples. A little bit of fear." That's not what he says. He doesn't use guilt and condemnation or even that kind of fear. There's a godly fear that is good. But Jesus came, touched them, and said, "Arise and do not be afraid." And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus alone. They were left with Jesus alone. Not with Moses, not with Elijah. We're left with Jesus alone. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead." And so they were to keep that between themselves until he was following his resurrection. And of course, Peter writes about this very event in one of his epistles, and John himself declares this event in the first chapter of his gospel. None of them ever forgot this experience in their lives. And so they begin to make their way down from the mountain. And when, as they were doing this, his disciples asked Jesus, saying, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And of course, the scribes taught that Elijah was going to return before the coming of Messiah, based upon the passage in Malachi that declared, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And Jesus said, answered them and said to them, verse 11, Elijah truly is coming first and will restore all things. And so Jesus is saying, listen, concerning Elijah, who was taken up in the fiery chariot into heaven, he said he is going to return. He is going to come first. And based upon this scripture in Malachi, and then some interesting aspects of Revelation chapter 11, I'm convinced that Elijah is one of the two witnesses of the great tribulation. And I personally believe that Moses is the other. But we won't disfellowship you if you hold a different view. But when you read what these two witnesses do there in Revelation chapter 11, Revelation is almost entirely... It has references to the Old Testament. If you let the Old Testament interpret it for you, you're on safe ground. And so these witnesses, one of the witnesses is able to have fire that proceeds from them, and then also the ability to cause a drought to come upon the land during the days of their prophecy. And those were characteristics of Elijah's ministry, where that fire came down from heaven on Mount Carmel, and then he prayed, and for 3.5 years, there was a drought there during the time of King Ahab in the region of Israel. And so Jesus says, listen, Elijah coming is a future event, and it is yet future even for us in this room tonight. But, he said in verse 12, I say to you that Elijah has come already, and they did not know him, but did to him whatever they wished. And likewise, the Son of Man is also about to suffer at their hands. And then the disciples understood that Jesus spoke to them of John the Baptist. And so Elijah is coming, but Jesus is saying, in a sense, he's already come in John the Baptist. And so Elijah will come as the forerunner to Jesus at his second coming. John the Baptist was a type of Elijah in Jesus' first coming. And when Zacharias, who was John the Baptist's father, was spoken to by the angel speaking of the coming miraculous birth of John the Baptist, he said that he will go before the Messiah in the spirit and the power of Elijah. So there was the spirit and the power of Elijah upon John the Baptist as he performed his ministry, and so he fulfilled it in that sense. And so now in verse 14, they come down to the base of the mountain. And classic lesson related to the passage is that mountaintop experiences come to an end. And there's a time to come down from the mountain and down into the valley. And when we come down into the valley of life, how often the devil is there or needy people are there. We'd like to live on the mountaintop all of our lives as Christians. And some people try to. They go from this conference to that conference to this thing to this thing. They never come into contact with a valley as long as they can afford the things. You know, but the idea is that we learn what we learn in the mountaintop experiences, but that God also takes us down into the valley to have come out of our life what we've learned on the mountaintop. And so the experience on the mountaintop is for us, but it's not only for us. There's a sense in which each one of us, every time we are any place where the Word of God is being opened up and it's being taught, for any of us in any environment, that we are not just listening for ourselves. We are listening for a group of people that are yet to come into our life. And so often when we go over to India or something, just kind of remind the fact, these young men, they're in these training centers and they're learning so much and they've got to stay focused and all these things to learn and to be encouraged, that they're not just listening for themselves, they're listening for thousands of others that are going to be impacted by their ministries. And it's the same thing for us. And so we're listening because God is going to use what we learn in those experiences and other places in life. And so how often when we come down from the mountaintop experience, there is some work of the devil at the base of the mountain. And that's what exactly what they run into at this time. Now, I think we have to be careful, you know, as it relates to this idea of, you know, coming down from the mountain and you're going to meet the devil when you come down from the mountain. It's a common thing, you know, when you're at a retreat, and it's absolutely authentic. Had this tremendous experience at a retreat or something. God has really met with us there and all. And you come down and you can just expect, you know, who knows what. Who knows what if you're a man. I can't even imagine what you women might expect when you go home from your ladies' retreat, having turned things over to us for 3 days. And so and you come down from that. But you don't want to give the devil more credit than he's due. Years ago, when we attended the Calvary Chapel in Napa, there was, I was a deacon there. Oh, you may not love it, but I love it. There was a deacon there, and we were there early for the Sunday night service, and the ladies' retreat had gotten done that morning. And so always there's that excitement. One of the hardest days of the year for me is the women's retreat day here, because there's got all of these women gone. And they add a dynamic to the church that's missing when it's not here. And so as wonderful as the guys are. So anyway, we were there getting things ready ahead of time. And one of the deacon's wives showed up, and she was talking with her husband, and she said, "We had a wonderful time at the retreat." And she said that the pastor's wife told us that when we come down from this mountaintop experience, you can just expect the devil to try and rip you off from the time that you've had. And she said, "I'll tell you, the devil tried to rip us off." She said, "I was driving home and her car was full of other Christian women, and she got pulled over for speeding by a CHP. She rolled down her window and said, 'The lady told us that the devil would be at the bottom of the hill here to try and rip us off from the thing.'" She's calling the CHP the devil. She was the one that was speeding, you know. So, I mean, you gotta keep things in perspective. The devil does enough without, you know, calling it that. I feel like a picture of that CHP. Oh, no. That probably makes some Reader's Digest magazine story. But they do come down in verse 14. "And when they had come down, had come to the multitude, there was a man who came to Jesus. And he was kneeling down to him, saying, 'Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic,'" and that is a very unfortunate translation, by the way. Literally, it's saying, "He is a lunatic." And in those days, Luna comes from the word moon. And so, when there was the full moon, in those days, if someone was demon-possessed or something like that, it would make them even wilder, even crazier. And so someone who was a lunatic was someone who was like constantly under the maddening effect of the moon. That's how they saw it. It's interesting, even today, in some of the major cities of the United States where violence is a particular problem, they will add extra staff to hospitals or to law enforcement in the city at the time of a full moon. There is something that sometimes happens related to all of that. So he said, "My son is a lunatic, and he suffers severely, for he oftentimes falls into the fire and often into the water." Now we're going to see in verse 18 that he's demon-possessed. This is the cause of all of his problems. And so the devil not only demon-possessing him, but then taking him and, you know, throwing him into the fire as a part of the possession, into water and the cruelty. One of the things about the devil is he doesn't know how to restrain himself. And so when he gets a hold of a life, his tendency is to go, you know, he just keeps escalating the crazy things that he does to a human life until, you know, people want to be rid of him. And so this man comes and he asks the Lord to deliver his son. Can you imagine having a son who was demon-possessed? Were the demons throwing him into the water and throwing him into the fire? I mean, and this guy doesn't know the Lord. I mean, he knows the Lord now, but I mean, there's no sense that he has this, that he's a Christian and he has this long history with the Lord or anything like that. All he knows is he's in a situation where he has no power over this thing at all, and he is day by day watching the devil kill his son. That's just as rough as you get. What do? You bring your son to Jesus. You bring him to Jesus. And so it is for our children, you know, tonight. What do we do when they're in this condition, and maybe not quite as bad as that condition? Who in the world can meet their needs and help us as parents but the Lord? And so Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long will I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him here to me. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and the demon came out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Well, the disciples were curious about their ineffectiveness in light of the demon. They had doubtless tried to cast the demon out and had not been able to do it. And so they came to Jesus privately. And you like to take your failures to the Lord privately. At least I do. And they said, why could we not cast him out? And it's a sincere question. And Jesus said to them, because of your unbelief, lack of faith, for assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind, apparently the demon that they were dealing with, does not go out except by prayer and by fasting. And so they said, what was the cause of our inability here? Jesus said, number one was unbelief. And then secondly, there was evidently a lack of prayer that was needed, verse 21, in the situation, and a lack of discipline or focus that the fasting would have provided. I'm convinced that personally that when they came to deliver the boy, that whatever was going on, whatever kind of thrashing, whatever kind of demonic manifestation that was going on in his life, it so overwhelmed their senses that that's all they could think about. They lost sight of the power of God, of God's authority in that situation, even though earlier in their ministries they had gone out and they had cast out demons. But they're coming up against a different kind of demon in the situation. And so Jesus is communicating apparently in verse 21 that a time of prayer and a time of fasting would have rectified things, in that it would have put their focus back strongly upon the Lord and the power of the Lord, instead of being overwhelmed with the power of the devil, and then they could have exercised their authority over that demon. There does seem to be different rankings of demons. Just as in our military, you know, we have privates, we have corporals, we have sergeants, and so on in our military. In the demonic realm, there seems to be different levels of authority among the demons. Paul wrote to the Ephesians, and he said, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, in Ephesians 6:12, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So he talks about principalities, powers, rulers, and it's almost like he's talking about kind of a hierarchy in terms of their power and their authority in different situations and different rankings. So we have authority over the demonic realm as believers, but in some situations it takes a little bit longer, and it takes prayer and fasting in order for that authority to become fully manifest in the situation. So it wasn't one that they ought to have given up on, but just gone to prayer and fasting related to that. Now, while they were staying in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, And the third day he will be raised up. And they were exceedingly sorrowful. So the Lord continues to prepare them for what he knows is now just a handful of months away. And when they had come into Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" Now, under the Jewish law, every adult male was to pay a half shekel annually as a tax to support the temple. And here is this guy that's sitting at the receipt of the taxes there in Capernaum, and he asked Peter, "Listen, is your teacher going to pay the temple tax?" And Peter said, "Yes." Did he really know that? I mean, he could have. Yeah. And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated, and Jesus knew what had happened. And he said to Peter, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their own sons or from strangers?" And Peter said, "Well, from strangers." And Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free." Now, when a king of any nation in the ancient world, when he would conquer a neighboring nation, he would tax that nation. He wouldn't tax his own people. He would basically kind of loot the other nation in order to gain the revenue that he wanted. No king ever taxed his children. Now, we live in the United States of America, which is unique in many ways in man's history, in that everyone is taxed, whether they're rich or poor, especially if they're rich. But anyway, it is a election year, isn't it? I'm not going to get into all of that. Tony, you can't draw me into this. I'm not going to do it. Okay. But anyway, so in ancient times, they would, tax particular segments. So it was unusual for a king to take and to tax his own people or his own children. And so here is Jesus. He's the son of the son of the Father. It's his temple. If he pays tribute to the temple, it's like he's paying tribute to himself. It doesn't make any sense. And so Jesus said to Peter, to him in verse 27, "Nevertheless, lest we offend them." And those are four words that are worthy of really noticing. "Lest we offend them, go out into the sea, cast in a hook, and take," and you notice it's "the fish, not a fish. Take the fish that comes first." It's almost like Jesus knows this fish. "Take the fish that comes up first, and when you have opened its mouth," again, like he knows the fish, "you'll find a piece of money. Take that and give it to them for me and for you." So Jesus says, there's no need to needlessly offend these people, so that then there's going to be a fight over a half shekel and they miss the message that I'm trying to bring to them. And so Jesus said, just so we don't needlessly offend, and it is not bad banner to live our life under as Christians. Sometimes we win and lose battles under things that are kind of nebulous and force people to lose sight of what's really important. And so he said, that nevertheless, lest we offend them, go ahead and do this. And it's interesting that Jesus provided for himself and for Peter. And I think that in situations where we take and we look and say, all right, in order not to offend, in order that the message of the gospel would not be ruined in this situation, I am not surprised at all that the Lord provides for us to take that higher road in the situations in our lives.